Chapter 64. Nine in the Fire. The next day, as luck would have it, I made a trip to Imray. Then, since I just happened to be in the neighborhood, I stopped by the Oaken Ore. The owner didn't know the name Denna or Diane, but a young, lovely, dark-haired girl named Dinna was renting a room there. She wasn't in right now, but if I cared to leave a note... I declined his offer, comforted by the fact that since I now knew where Denna was staying, finding her would be relatively easy. However, I had no luck catching Denna at the Oaken Ore over the next 2 days. On the third day, the owner informed me that Denna had left in the middle of the night, taking all her things and leaving her bill unpaid. After stopping by a few taverns at random and not finding her, I walked back to the university, not knowing if I should be worried or irritated. 3 more days and 5 more fruitless trips to Imray. Neither Diok nor Threp had heard any news of her. Diok told me that it was her nature to disappear like this, and that looking for her would serve about as much purpose as calling for a cat. I knew it to be good advice, and ignored it. I sat in Kilvin's office trying to look calm as the great shaggy master turned my sympathy lamp over in his huge hands. It was my first solo project as an artificer. I'd cast the plates and ground the lenses. I'd doped the emitter without giving myself arsenic poisoning. Most importantly, mine was the ailer and the intricate sigildry that turned the individual pieces into a functioning handheld sympathy lamp. If Kilvin approved of the finished product, he would sell it and I would receive part of the money as a commission. More importantly, I would become an artificer in my own right, albeit a fledgling one. I would be trusted to pursue my own projects with a large degree of freedom. It was a big step forward in the ranks of the fishery, a step toward gaining the rank of Relar, and more importantly, my financial freedom. Finally, he looked up.
"This is finally made, Ilir Kvoth," he said, "but the design is not typical."
I nodded. "I made a few changes, sir. If you turn it on, you'll see..." Kilvin made a low sound that could have been an amused chuckle or an irritated grunt. He set the lamp down on the table and walked around the room, snuffing all the lamps but one.
"Do you know how many sympathy lamps I have had explode in my hands over the years, Ilir Kvoth?"
I swallowed and shook my head. "How many?"
"None," he said gravely. "Because I am always careful. I am always absolutely sure of what I hold in my hands. You must learn patience, Ilir Kvoth. A moment in the mind is worth 9 in the fire."
I dropped my eyes and tried to look appropriately chastised. Kilvin reached out and extinguished the one remaining lamp, bringing the room to near total darkness. There was a pause. Then a distinctive reddish light welled from the hand lamp to shine against a wall. The light was very dim, less than that of a single candle. "The action on the switch is graded," I said quickly. "It's more of a rheostat than a switch, really." Kilvin nodded.
"Cleverly done. That is not something most bother with on a small lamp such as this."
The light grew brighter, then dimmer, then brighter again.
"The sigildry itself seems quite good,"
Kilvin said slowly as he set the lamp down on the table.
"But the focus of your lens is flawed. There is very little diffusion."
It was true. Instead of lighting the whole room, as was typical, my lamp revealed a narrow slice of the room, the corner of the work table and half of the large black slate that stood against the wall. The rest of the room remained dark. "It's intentional," I said. "There are lanterns like that, bullseye lanterns." Kilvin was little more than a dark shape across the table.
"Such things are known to me, Ilir Kvoth."
His voice held a hint of reproach.
"They are much used for unsavory business. Business arcana should have no mingling with."
"I thought sailors used them," I said.
"Burglars use them," Kilvin said seriously. "And spies, and other folk who do not wish to reveal their business during the dark hours of night."
My vague anxiety grew suddenly sharper. I had considered this meeting mostly a formality, I knew I was a skilled artificer, better than many who had worked much longer in Kilvin's shop. Now I was suddenly worried that I might have made a mistake and wasted nearly 30 hours of work on the lamp, not to mention over a whole talent of my own money that I'd invested in materials. Kilvin made a non-committal grunt and muttered under his breath. The half-dozen oil lamps around the room sputtered back into life, filling the room with natural light. I marveled at the master's casual execution of a six-way binding. I couldn't even guess where he had drawn the energy from. "It's just that everyone makes a sympathy lamp for their first project," I said to fill the silence. "Everyone always follows the same old schema. I wanted to do something different. I wanted to see if I could make something new."
"I expect you wanted to demonstrate your extreme cleverness," Kilvin said matter-of-factly. "You wish to not only finish your apprenticeship in half the usual time, you wanted to bring me a lamp of your own improved design. Let us be frank, Ilir Kvothe. You're making this lamp as an attempt to show that you are better than the ordinary apprentice, is it not?"
As he said this, Kilvin looked directly at me, and for a moment there was none of his characteristic distraction lurking behind his eyes. I felt my mouth go dry. Underneath his shaggy beard and heavily accented A-Turin, Kilvin had a mind like a diamond. What had made me think I could lie to him and get away with it? "Of course I wanted to impress you, Master Kilvin," I said, looking down. "I would think that that goes without saying."
"Do not grovel," he said. "False modesty does not impress me."
I looked up and squared my shoulders. "In that case, Master Kilvin, I am better. I learn faster, I work harder, my hands are more nimble, my mind is more curious. However, I also expect you to know this for yourself without my telling you." Kilvin nodded.
"That is better. And you are right. I do know these things."
He thumbed the lamp on and off while pointing it at different things around the room.
"And in all fairness, I am duly impressed with your skill. The lamp is tidily made. The sigilder is quite cunning. The engraving precise. It is clever work."
I flushed with pleasure at the compliments.
"But there is more to artificing than simply skill," Kilvin said as he laid the lamp down and spread his huge hands out flat on either side of it. "I cannot sell this lamp. It would gravitate to the wrong people. If a burglar were caught with such a tool, it would reflect badly on all arcanists. You have completed your apprenticeship and distinguished yourself in terms of skill."
I relaxed a bit.
"But your greater judgment is still somewhat in question. The lamp itself we will melt down for metals, I suppose."
"You're going to melt down my lamp?" I had worked for a full span on the lamp and invested almost all the money I had on the purchase of raw materials. I had been counting on making a tidy profit once Kilvin sold it. But now... Kilvin's expression was firm.
"We are all responsible for maintaining the university's reputation, Ilir Kvothe. An item like this in the wrong hands would reflect badly on all of us."
I was trying to think of some way to persuade him when he waved a hand at me, shooing me toward the door.
"Go tell Manette your good news."
Disheartened, I made my way out into the workshop and was greeted by the sounds of 100 hands busily chiseling wood, chipping stone, and hammering metal. The air was thick with the smell of etching acids, hot iron, and sweat. I spotted Manette off in the corner, loading tile into a kiln. I waited until he closed the door and backed away, mopping sweat off his forehead with the sleeve of his shirt.
"How did it go?" he asked. "Did you pass, or am I going to be stuck holding your hand for another term?"
"I passed," I said dismissively. "You were right about the modifications. He wasn't impressed."
"Told you,"
he said without any particular smugness.
"You have to remember that I've been here longer than any 10 students. When I tell you the masters are conservatives at heart, I'm not just making noise. I know."
Manette ran a hand idly over his wild gray beard as he eyed the heat waves rolling off the brick kiln.
"Any thoughts on what you're going to do with yourself now that you're a free agent?"
"I was thinking of doping a batch of the blue lamp emitters," I said.
"The money is good," Manette said slowly. "Risky, though.
You know I'm careful, I reassured him.
Risky is risky, Manette said. I trained a fellow maybe 10 years back. What was his name?
He tapped his head for a moment, then shrugged.
He made a little slip. Manette snapped his fingers sharply. But that's all it takes. Got burned pretty badly and lost a couple fingers. Wasn't much of an artificer afterward.
I looked across the room at Kamar with his missing eye and bald, scarred head. Point taken. I flexed my hands anxiously as I looked over at the burnished metal canister. People had been nervous around it for a day or two after Kilvin's demonstration, but it had soon become just another piece of equipment. The truth was, there were 10,000 different ways to die in the fishery if you were careless. Bone tar just happened to be the newest, most exciting way to kill yourself. I decided to change the subject. Can I ask you a question?
Fire away, he said, glancing at the nearby kiln. Get it? Fire away?
I rolled my eyes. Would you say you know the university as well as anyone? He nodded.
As well as anyone alive. All the dirty little secrets.
I lowered my voice a bit. So, if you wanted to, you could get into the archives without anyone knowing? Manette's eyes narrowed.
I could, he said, but I wouldn't.
I started to say something, but he cut me off with more than a hint of exasperation.
Listen, my boy, we've talked about this before. Just be patient. You need to give Lauren more time to cool off. It's only been a term or so. It's been half a year.
He shook his head.
That only seems like a long time to you because you're young. Believe me, it's fresh in Lauren's mind. Just spend another term or so impressing Kilvin, then ask him to intercede on your behalf. Trust me, it'll work.
I put on my best hangdog expression. You could just... He shook his head firmly.
No, 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 I won't show you. I won't tell you, I won't draw you a map.
He softened his expression and lay a hand on my shoulder, obviously trying to take some of the sting out of his bald refusal.
Hey, Lou, anyway, why all the hurry? You're young. You have all the time in the world.
He leveled a finger at me.
But if you get expelled, it's forever. And that's what'll happen if you're caught sneaking into the archives.
I let my shoulders slump, dejected. You're right, I suppose.
That's right, I'm right, Manette said, turning back to look at the kiln. Now run along. You're giving me an ulcer.
I walked away, thinking furiously about Manette's advice and what he had let slip in our conversation. In general, I knew his advice was good. If I were well behaved for a term or two, I would get access to the archives. It was the safe, simple route to what I wanted. Unfortunately, I couldn't afford patience. I was painfully aware of the fact that this term would be my last unless I could find a way to make a great deal of money rather quickly. No, patience wasn't an option for me. On my way out, I peered inside Kilvin's office and saw him sitting at his work table, idly thumbing my lamp on and off. His expression was distracted again, and I didn't doubt that his vast machine of a brain was busy thinking about a half dozen things all at once. I knocked on the doorframe to get his attention. Master Kilvin? He didn't turn to look at me.
Yes?
Could I buy the lamp? I asked. I could use it to read at night. Right now I'm still spending money on candles. I briefly considered wringing my hands before deciding against it. Too melodramatic. Kilvin thought for a long moment. The lamp in his hand gave a soft tick as he switched it on again.
You cannot buy what your own hands build, he said. The time and materials that made it were yours.
He held it out to me. I stepped into the room to take it, but Kilvin drew his hand back and met my eye.
I must make clear one thing, he said seriously. You cannot sell or lend this, not even to someone you trust. If it is lost, it would eventually end up in the wrong hands and be used for skulking about in the dark, doing dishonest things.
I give you my word, Master Kilvin, no one will be using it but me. As I left the shop, I was careful to keep my expression neutral, but inside, I was wearing a wide, satisfied smile. Manette had told me exactly what I needed to know. There was another way into the archives, a hidden way. If it existed, I could find it. Chapter 65. Spark. I lured Will and Sim to the Aeolian with the promise of free drinks, the one piece of generosity I could afford. You see, while Ambrose's interference might keep me from gaining a wealthy noble as a patron, there were still plenty of regular music lovers who bought me more drinks than I could comfortably consume on my own. There were two simple solutions to this. I could become a drunk, or use an arrangement that has been around for as long as there have been taverns and musicians. Attend to me as I draw back the curtain to reveal a long-kept minstrel's secret. Let's say you are out at an inn. You listen to me play. You laugh, cry, and generally marvel at my craft. Afterward, you want to show your appreciation, but you don't have the wherewithal to make a substantial gift of money like some wealthy merchant or noble. So you offer to buy me a drink. I, however, have already had a drink, or several drinks, or perhaps I am trying to keep a clear head. Do I refuse your offer? Of course not. That would just waste a valuable opportunity and most likely leave you feeling snubbed. Instead, I graciously accept and ask bartender for a Graysdale mead, or a Sauntern, or a particular vintage of white wine. The name of the drink isn't the important thing. The important thing is that the drink doesn't really exist. The bartender gives me water. You pay for the drink. I thank you graciously, and everyone walks away happy. Later, the bartender, the tavern, and the musician share your money three ways. Better yet, some sophisticated drinking establishments allow you to keep drinks as a sort of credit for future use. The Aeolian was just such a place. That is how, despite my poverty-stricken state, I managed to bring an entire dark bottle of Scutton back to the table where Will and Sim waited. Will eyed it appreciatively as I sat down.
"What's the special occasion?"
Kilvin approved my sympathy lamp. "You're looking at the Arcanum's newest journeyman artificer," I said a little smugly. "Most students spend at least 3 or 4 terms finishing their apprenticeships." I kept my mixed success with the lamp to myself.
"About time," Will said dryly. "Took you what, almost 3 months? People were beginning to say that you had lost your touch."
"I thought you'd be more pleased," I said as I peeled the wax off the top of the bottle. "My days of being a pinchpenny might be coming to an end." Sim made a dismissive noise. "You stand your round well enough," he said.
"I drink to your continued success as an artificer," Will said, sliding his cup toward me. "Knowing it will lead to more drinks in the future."
"Plus," I said as I stripped the last of the wax away, "there's always the chance that if I get you drunk enough, you'll let me slip into the archives someday when you're working the desk." I kept my tone carefully jovial as I glanced up at him to gauge his reaction. Will took a slow drink, not meeting my eye.
"I can't."
Disappointment nestled sourly in the pit of my stomach. I made a dismissive gesture, as if I couldn't believe he'd taken my joke seriously.
"Oh, I know. I thought about it,"
Willem interrupted.
"Seeing as how you didn't deserve the punishment you got, and I know how much it's been bothering you."
Will took a drink.
"Lauren occasionally suspends students. A handful of days for too loud talking in the tomes. A few span if they're careless with a book. But banned is different. It hasn't happened in years. Everyone knows. If anyone saw you..."
He shook his head.
"I'd lose my position as scrive. We could both get expelled."
"Don't beat yourself up," I said. "Just the fact that you considered it means..."
"We're getting maudlin here," Sim broke in, knocking his glass against the table. "Open the bottle and we'll drink to Kilvin being so impressed that he talks to Lauren and gets you unbanned from the archives."
I smiled and began to work a screw into the cork.
"I have a better plan," I said.
I vote we drink to the perpetual confusion and botherment of a certain Ambrose Jackis.
I think we can all agree to that, Will said, raising his glass.
Great God, Simmons said in a hushed tone. Look what Diok found. What's that? I asked, concentrating on getting the cork out all in one piece. He managed to get the most beautiful woman in the place again. Sim's grumble was uncharacteristically surly. It's enough to make you hate a man. Sim, your taste in women is questionable at best. The cork came free with a pleasing sound, and I held it up triumphantly for them to see. Neither of them paid me any attention, their eyes pinned to the doorway. I turned to look. Paused. That's Denna. Sim turned back to look at me. Denna? I frowned. Diane, Denna. She's the one I told you about before. The one who sang with me. She goes by a lot of different names. I don't know why. Willem gave me a flat look.
That's your girl?
He asked, his voice thick with disbelief. Diok's girl, Simon amended gently. It seemed to be the case. Handsome, muscular Diok was talking to her in that easy way he had. Denna laughed and put an arm around him in a casual embrace. I felt a heavy weight settle in my chest as I watched them talk. Then Diok turned and pointed. She followed his gesture, met my eyes, and lit up as she smiled at me. I returned the smile by reflex alone. My heart began to beat again. I waved her over. After a quick word to Diok, she began to make her way through the crowd toward us. I took a quick drink of scutton as Simon turned to look at me with an almost reverent disbelief. I had never seen Denna dressed in anything other than traveling clothes, but tonight she was wearing a dark green dress that left her arms and shoulders bare. She was stunning. She knew it. She smiled. The three of us stood as she approached. "I was hoping to find you here," she said. I gave a small bow.
"I was hoping to be found. These are two of my best friends. Simon,"
Sim smiled sunnily and brushed his hair away from his eyes. "And Willem," Will nodded. "This is Diane." She lounged into a chair. "What brings such a group of handsome young men out on the town tonight?"
"We're plotting the downfall of our enemies," Simon said. "And celebrating," I hurried to add.
Willem raised his glass in a salute.
"Confusion to the enemy!"
Simon and I followed suit, but I stopped when I remembered Denna didn't have a glass. "I'm sorry," I said. "Can I buy you a drink?"
"I was hoping you would buy me dinner," she said. "But I would feel guilty about stealing you away from your friends."
My mind raced as I tried to think of a tactful way to extricate myself.
"You're making the assumption that we want him here," Willem said with a straight face. "You'd do us a favor if you took him away."
Denna leaned forward intently, a smile brushing the pink corners of her mouth.
"Really?"
Willem nodded gravely.
"He drinks even more than he talks."
She darted a teasing look at me.
"That much?"
"Besides," Simon chimed in innocently, "he'd sulk for days if he missed a chance to be with you. He'll be completely worthless to us if you leave him here." My face grew hot, and I had the sudden urge to throttle Sim. Denna laughed sweetly.
"I suppose I better take him, then."
She stood with a motion like a willow wand, bending to the wind, and offered me her hand. I took it.
"I hope to see you again, Willem, Simon."
They waved and we started to make our way to the door.
"I like them," she said. "Willem is a stone in deep water. Simon is like a boy splashing in a brook."
Her description startled a laugh from me. I couldn't have said it better.
"You mentioned dinner." "I lied," she said with an easy delight. "But I would love the drink you offered me."
"How about the taps?"
She wrinkled her nose. "Too many old men, not enough trees. It is a good night to be out of doors."
I gestured toward the door.
"Lead the way."
She did. I basked in her reflected light and the stares of envious men. As we left the Aeolian, even Diok looked a little jealous, but as I passed him, I caught a glimmer of something other in his eye.
Sadness? Pity? I spared no time for it. I was with Denna. We bought a loaf of dark bread and a bottle of a Venice strawberry wine, then found a private place in one of the many public gardens scattered throughout Imre. The first of autumn's falling leaves danced along the streets beside us. Denna removed her shoes and danced lightly through the shadows, delighting in the feel of the grass beneath her feet. We settled on a bench beneath a great spreading willow, then abandoned it and found more comfortable seats on the ground at the foot of the tree. The bread was thick and dark, and tearing chunks of it gave us distraction for our hands. The wine was sweet and light, and after Denna kissed the bottle, it left her lips wet for an hour. It had the desperate feel of the last warm night of summer. We spoke of everything and nothing, and all the while I could hardly breathe for the nearness of her, the way she moved, the sound of her voice as it touched the autumn air. "Your eyes were far away just then," she said. "What were you thinking?" I shrugged, buying a moment to think. I couldn't tell her the truth. I knew every man must compliment her, bury her in flattery more cloying than roses. I took a subtler path. "One of the masters at the university once told me that there were 7 words that would make a woman love you." I made a deliberately casual shrug. "I was just wondering what they were." "Is that why you talk so much? Hoping to come on them by accident?" I opened my mouth to retort. Then, seeing her dancing eyes, I pressed my lips together and tried to fight down my embarrassed flush. She lay a hand on my arm. "Don't go quiet on my account, Kvothe," she said gently. "I'd miss the sound of your voice." She took a drink of wine. "Anyway, you shouldn't bother wondering. You spoke them to me when we first met. You said, 'I was just wondering why you're here.'" She made a flippant gesture. "From that moment, I was yours." My mind flashed back to our first meeting in Rowan's caravan. I was stunned. "I didn't think you remembered." She paused in tearing a piece of dark bread away from the loaf and looked up at me quizzically.
"Remember what?"
"Remembered me. Remembered our meeting in Rowan's caravan."
"Come now," she teased. "How could I forget the red-haired boy who left me for the university?"
I was too stunned to point out that I hadn't left her. Not really.
"You never mentioned it."
"Neither did you," she countered.
"Perhaps I thought that you had forgotten me."
"Forget you? How could I?" She smiled at that, but looked down at her hands.
"You might be surprised what men forget," she said, then lightened her tone.
"But then again, perhaps not. I don't doubt that you've forgotten things, being a man yourself."
"I remember your name, Denna."
It sounded good to say it to her.
"Why did you take a new one? Or was Denna just the name that you were wearing on the road to Annalyn?"
"Denna," she said softly. "I'd almost forgotten her. She was a silly girl. She was like a flower unfolding. I stopped being Denna years ago, it seems."
She rubbed her bare arms and looked around as if she was suddenly uneasy that someone might find us here.
"Should I call you Diane, then? Would you like it better?"
The wind stirred the hanging branches of the willow as she cocked her head to look at me. Her hair mimicked the motion of the trees.
"You are kind. I think I like Denna best from you. It sounds different when you say it. Gentle."
"Denna it is," I said firmly. "What happened in Annalyn, anyway?"
A leaf floated down and landed in her hair. She brushed it away absent-mindedly.
"Nothing pleasant," she said, avoiding my eyes.
"But nothing unexpected, either."
I held out my hand and she passed me back the loaf of bread.
"Well, I'm glad you made it back," I said. "My Eloine."
She made a decidedly unladylike noise.
"Please, if either of us is Savian, it's me. I'm the one that came looking for you," she pointed out.
twice.
I look, I protested. I just don't seem to have a knack for finding you.
She rolled her eyes dramatically.
If you could recommend an auspicious time and place to look for you, it would make a world of difference.
I trailed off gently, making it a question.
Perhaps tomorrow?
Denna gave me a sideways glance, smiling.
You're always so cautious, she said. I've never known a man to step so carefully.
She looked at my face as if it were a puzzle she could solve.
I expect noon would be an auspicious time tomorrow.
At the Aeolian?
I felt a warm glow at the thought of meeting her again.
I was just wondering why you're here, I mused aloud, remembering the conversation that seemed so long ago.
You called me a liar afterward.
She leaned forward to touch my hand in a consoling way. She smelled of strawberry, and her lips were a dangerous red even in the moonlight.
How well I knew you, even then.
We talked through the long hours of the night. I spoke subtle circles around the way I felt, not wanting to be overbold. I thought she might be doing the same, but I could never be sure. It was like we were doing one of those elaborate Modegan court dances where the partners stand scant inches apart, but, if they are skilled, never touch. Such was our conversation. But not only were we lacking touch to guide us, it was as if we were also strangely deaf. So we danced very carefully, unsure what music the other was listening to. Unsure, perhaps, if the other was dancing at all.
Diak was standing vigil at the door, same as always. He waved to see me.
Master Quoth, I'm afraid you missed your friends.
I thought I might have. How long have they been gone?
Only an hour.
He stretched his arms above his head, grimacing, then let them fall to his sides with a weary sigh.
Did they seem put out that I abandoned them?
He grinned.
Not terribly. They happened on a couple of lovelies of their own. Not as lovely as yours, of course.
He looked uncomfortable for a moment, then spoke slowly as if he were picking his words with great care.
Looks. Quoth. I know it's not my place, and I hope you don't take it wrong.
He looked around and suddenly spat.
Damn. I'm no good at this sort of thing.
He looked back at me and gestured vaguely with his hands.
You see, women are like fires, like flames. Some women are like candles, bright and friendly. Some are like single sparks or embers, like fireflies for chasing on summer nights. Some are like campfires, all light and heat for a night and willing to be left after. Some women are like hearth fires, not much to look at, but underneath, they are all warm, red coal that burns a long, long while. But Diane is like a waterfall of spark pouring off a sharp iron edge that God is holding to the grindstone. You can't help but look, can't help but want it. You might even put your hand to it for a second, but you can't hold it. She'll break your heart.
The evening was too fresh in my memory for me to pay much heed to Diak's warning. I smiled.
Diak, my heart is made of stronger stuff than glass. When she strikes, she'll find it strong as iron-bound brass, or gold and adamant together mixed. Don't think I am unaware, some startled deer to stand transfixed by hunter's horns. It's she who should take care, for when she strikes, my heart will make a sound so beautiful and bright that it can't help but bring her back to me in winged flight.
My words startled Diak into bemused laughter.
God, you're brave! He shook his head. And young! I wish I were as brave and young as you.
Still smiling, he turned to enter the Aeolian.
Good night, Zen!
Good night.
Diak wished that he were more like me. It was as great a compliment as any I had ever been given.
But even better than that was the fact that my days of fruitlessly searching for Denna were at an end. Tomorrow, at noon in the Aeolian, lunch and talking and walking, as she had phrased it, the thought filled me with a giddy excitement. How young I was. How foolish. How wise. Chapter 66. Volatile. I woke early the next morning, nervous at the thought of lunch with Denna. Knowing it would be useless to attempt to get back to sleep, I headed to the fishery. Last night's extravagant spending had left me with exactly 3 pennies in my pocket, and I was eager to take advantage of my newly earned position. Usually, I worked nights in the fishery. It was a different place in the mornings. There were only 15 or 20 people there pursuing their individual projects. In the evenings, there were usually twice that many. Kilvin was in his office, as always, but the atmosphere was more relaxed. Busy, but not bustling. I even saw Fella off in the corner of the shop, chipping carefully away at a piece of obsidian the size of a large loaf of bread. Small wonder I'd never seen her here before, if she made a habit of being in the shop this early. Despite Manette's warning, I decided to make a batch of blue emitters for my first project. Tricky work, as it required the use of bone tar, but they would sell fairly quickly, and the whole process would only take me 4 or 5 hours of careful work. Not only could I be done in time to meet with Denna at the Aeolian for lunch, but I might be able to get a small advance from Kilvin so I could have a bit of money in my purse when I went to meet her. I gathered the necessary tools and set up in one of the fume hoods along the eastern wall. I chose a place near a drench, one of the 500-gallon tanks of twice-tough glass that were spaced throughout the workshop. If you'd spilled something dangerous on yourself while working in the hoods, you could simply pull the drench's handle and rinse yourself clean in a stream of cool water. Of course, I would never need the drench so long as I was careful, but it was nice having it close, just in case. After setting up the fume hood, I made my way to the table where the bone tar was kept. Despite the fact that I knew it was no more dangerous than a stone saw or the sintering wheel, I found the burnished metal container unnerving. And today, something was different. I caught the attention of one of the more experienced artificers as he walked past. Jackson had the haggard look common to most artificers in the middle of large projects, as if he were putting off sleep until it was entirely finished. "Should there be this much frost?" I asked him, pointing out the tar canister. Its edges were covered in fine white tufts of frost, like tiny shrubs. The air around the metal actually shimmered with cold. Jackson peered at it, then shrugged. "Better too cold than not cold enough," he said with a humorless chuckle. "Kaboom!" I couldn't help but agree, and guessed that it might have something to do with the workshop being cooler this early in the morning. None of the kilns had been fired up yet, and most of the forge fires were still banked and sullen. Moving carefully, I ran through the decanting procedure in my head, making sure I hadn't forgotten anything. It was so cold that my breath hung white in the air. The sweat on my hands froze my fingers to the canister's fastenings the same way a curious child's tongue sticks to a pump handle in the dead of winter. I decanted about an ounce of the thick, oily liquid into a pressure vial and quickly applied the cap. Then I made my way back to the fume hood and started preparing my materials. After a few tense minutes, I began the long, meticulous process of preparing and doping a set of blue emitters. My concentration was broken 2 hours later by a voice behind me. It wasn't particularly loud, but it held a serious tone you never ignore in the fishery. It said, "Oh my God." Because of my current work, the first thing I looked at was the bone tar canister. I felt a flash of cold sweat roll over me when I saw black liquid leaking from one corner and running down the work table's leg to pool on the floor. The thick timber of the table's leg was almost entirely eaten away, and I heard a light popping and crackling as the liquid pooling on the floor began to boil. All I could think of was Kilvin's statement during the demonstration.
"In addition to being highly corrosive, the gas burns when it comes in contact with air."
Even as I turned to look, The leg gave way, and the work table began to tip. The burnished metal canister tumbled down. When it struck the stone floor, the metal was so cold it didn't simply crack or dent. It shattered like glass. Gallons of the dark fluid burst out in a great splay across the workshop floor. The room filled with sharp crackling and popping sounds as the bone tar spread across the warm stone floor and started to boil. Long ago, the clever person who designed the fishery placed about 2 dozen drains in the workshop to help with cleaning and managing spills. What's more, the workshop's stone floor rose and fell in a gentle pattern of peaks and troughs to guide the spills toward those drains. That meant as soon as the container shattered, the wide spill of oily liquid began to run off in 2 different directions, heading for 2 different drains. At the same time, it continued to boil, forming thick, low clouds, dark as tar, caustic, and ready to burst into flame. Trapped between these 2 spreading arms of dark fog was Fella, who had been working by herself at an out-of-the-way table in the corner of the shop. She stood, her mouth half open in shock. She was dressed practically for work in the shop, light trousers and a gauzy linen shirt cuffed at the elbow. Her long, dark hair was pulled back into a tail, but still hung down to nearly the small of her back. She would burn like a torch. The room began to fill with frantic noise as people realized what was happening. They shouted orders or simply yelled in panic. They dropped tools and knocked over half-finished projects as they scrambled around. Fella hadn't screamed or called for help, which meant no one but me had noticed the danger she was in. If Kilvin's demonstration was any indication, I guess the whole shop could be a sea of flame and caustic fog in less than a minute. There wasn't any time. I glanced at the scattered projects on the nearby work table, looking for anything that could be of some help, but there was nothing. A jumble of basalt blocks, spools of copper wire, a half-inscribed hemisphere of glass that was probably destined to become one of Kilvin's lamps. And as easy as that, I knew what I had to do. I grabbed the glass hemisphere and dashed it against one of the basalt blocks. It shattered, and I was left with a thin, curved shard of broken glass about the size of my palm. With my other hand, I grabbed my cloak from the table and strode past the fume hood. I pressed my thumb against the edge of the piece of glass and felt an unpleasant tugging sensation, followed by a sharp pain. Knowing I'd drawn blood, I smeared my thumb across the glass and spoke a binding. As I came to stand in front of the drench, I dropped the glass to the floor, concentrated, and stepped down hard, crushing it with my heel. Cold, unlike anything I'd ever felt, stabbed into me. Not the simple cold you feel in your skin and limbs on a winter day. It hit my body like a clap of thunder. I felt it in my tongue and lungs and liver. But I got what I wanted. The twice-tough glass of the drench spiderwebbed into 1,000 fractures, and I closed my eyes just as it burst. 500 gallons of water struck me like a great fist, knocking me back a step and soaking me through to the skin. Then I was off, running between the tables. Quick as I wasn't quick enough. There was a blinding crimson flare from the corner of the workshop as the fog began to catch fire, sending up strangely angular tongues of violent red flame. The fire would heat the rest of the tar, causing it to boil more quickly. This would make more fog, more fire, and more heat. As I ran, the fire spread. It followed the 2 trails the bone tar made as it ran toward the drains. The flames shot up with startling ferocity, sending up 2 curtains of fire, effectively cutting off the far corner of the shop. The flames were already as tall as me and growing. Fella had worked her way out from behind the workbench and hurried along the wall toward one of the floor drains. Since the bone tar was pouring down the grate, there was a gap close to the wall, clear of flame or fog. Fella was just about to sprint past when dark fog began to boil up out of the grate. She gave a short, startled shriek as she backed away. The fog was burning even as it boiled up, engulfing everything in a roiling pool of flame. I finally made my way past the last table. Without slowing, I held my breath, closed my eyes, and jumped over the fog, not wanting to let the horrible, corrosive stuff touch my legs. I felt a brief, intense flash of heat on my hands and face, but my wet clothing kept me from being burned or catching fire. Since my eyes were closed, I landed awkwardly, banging my hip against the stone top of a work table. I ignored it and ran to Fella. She had been backing away from the fire toward the outer wall of the shop, but now she was staring at me, hands half raised protectively. "Put your arms down!" I shouted as I ran up to her, spreading my dripping wet cloak with both hands. I don't know if she heard me over the roar of the flames, but regardless, Fella understood. She lowered her hands and stepped toward the cloak. As I closed the final distance between us, I glanced behind and saw the fire was growing even faster than I'd expected. The fog clung to the floor over a foot deep, black as pitch. The flames were so high I couldn't see to the other side, let alone guess how thick the wall of fire had become. Just before Fella stepped into the cloak, I lifted it to completely engulf her head. "I'm going to have to carry you out!" I shouted as I bundled the cloak around her. "Your legs will burn if you try to wade through!" She said something in reply, but it was muffled by the layers of wet cloth, and I couldn't make it out over the roar of the fire. I picked her up, not in front of me, like Prince Gallant out of some storybook, but over one shoulder, the way you carry a sack of potatoes. Her hip pressed hard into my shoulder, and I pelted toward the fire. The heat battered the front of my body, and I threw my free arm up to protect my face, praying the moisture on my pants would save my legs from the worst of the corrosive nature of the fog. I drew a deep breath just before I hit the fire, but the air was sharp and acrid. I coughed reflexively and sucked down another lungful of the burning air just as I entered the wall of flame. I felt the sharp chill of the fog around my lower legs, and there was fire all around me as I ran, coughing and drawing in more bad air. I grew dizzy and tasted ammonia. Some distant, rational part of my mind thought, of course, to make it volatile. Then nothing. When I awoke, the first thing that sprang to my mind was not what you might expect. Then again, it may not be that much of a surprise if you have ever been young yourself. "What time is it?" I asked frantically. "First bell after noon," a female voice said. "Don't try to get up." I slumped back against the bed. I was supposed to have met with Denna at the Aeolian an hour ago. Miserable and with a sour knot in my stomach, I took in my surroundings. The distinctive antiseptic tang in the air let me know that I was somewhere in the Medica. The bed was a giveaway, too. Comfortable enough to sleep in, but not so comfortable that you'd want to lie around. I turned my head and saw a familiar pair of striking green eyes framed by close-cropped blonde hair. "Oh." I relaxed back onto the pillow. "Hello, Mola." Mola stood next to one of the tall counters that lined the edges of the room. The classic dark colors of those who worked at the Medica made her pale complexion seem even more so. "Hello, Quoth," she said, continuing to write her treatment report. "I heard you finally got promoted to Alpha," I said. "Congratulations. Everyone knows you deserved it a long time ago." She looked up, her pale lips curving into a small smile. "The heat doesn't seem to have damaged the gilding on your tongue." She lay down her pen. "How does the rest of you feel?"
"My legs feel fine, but numb, so I'm guessing I got burned, but you've already done something about it."
I lifted up the bedsheet, looked underneath it, then tucked it carefully back into place. "I also seem to be in an advanced state of undress." I felt a momentary panic. "Is Fella all right?" Mola nodded seriously and moved closer to stand by the side of the bed. "She has a bruise or two from when you dropped her, and is a little singed around the ankles, but she came out of it better than you did." "How is everyone else from the fishery?" "Surprisingly good, all things considered. A few burns from heat or acid, one case of metal poisoning, but it was minor. Smoke tends to be the real troublemaker with fires, but whatever was burning over there didn't seem to give off any smoke." "It did give off a sort of ammonia fume." I took a few deep experimental breaths. "But my lungs don't seem to be burned," I said, relieved. "I only got about 3 breaths of it before I passed out." There was a knock on the door, and Sim's head popped in. "You're not naked, are you?"
Mostly, I said, but the dangerous parts are covered up.
Willem followed in, looking distinctly uncomfortable.
You're not nearly as pink as you were before, he said. I'm guessing that's a good sign.
His legs are going to hurt for a while, but there's no permanent damage, she said. I brought fresh clothes, Sim said cheerfully. The ones you were wearing were ruined.
I hope you chose something suitable from my vast wardrobe, I said dryly to hide my embarrassment.
Sim shrugged off my comment.
You showed up without shoes, but I couldn't find another pair in your room.
I don't have a second pair, I said as I took the bundle of clothes from Sim. It's fine. I've been barefoot before. I walked away from my little adventure without any permanent damage. However, right now there wasn't a part of me that didn't hurt. I had flash burn across the backs of my hands and neck, and mild acid burns across my lower legs from where I'd waded through the fire fog. Despite all this, I made my limping way the long 3 miles across the river to Imre, hoping against hope that I might still find Denna waiting. Diak eyed me speculatively as I crossed the courtyard toward the Aeolian. He looked me up and down pointedly.
Lord boy, you look like you fell off a horse. Where are your shoes?
A good morning to you too, I said sarcastically.
A good afternoon,
he corrected with a significant glance up at the sun. I began to brush past him, but he held up a hand to stop me.
She's gone, I'm afraid.
Black sodding damn! I slumped, too weary to curse my luck properly. Diak gave me a sympathetic grimace.
She asked about you, he said consolingly, and waited for a good long while, too, almost an hour. Longest I've ever seen that one sit still.
Did she leave with someone? Diak looked down at his hands, where he was toying with a copper penny, rolling it back and forth over his knuckles.
She's not really the sort of girl who spends a lot of time alone.
He gave me a sympathetic look.
She turned a few away, but did eventually leave with a fellow. I don't think she was really with him, if you catch my meaning. She's been looking for a patron, and this fellow had this sort of look about him. White-haired, wealthy, you know the type.
I sighed. If you happen to see her, could you tell her... I paused, trying to think of how I could describe what had happened. Can you make unavoidably detained sound a little more poetic?
I reckon I can. I'll describe your hangdog look and shoeless state for her, too. Lay you a good solid groundwork for some grovelling.
I smiled despite myself. Thanks.
Can I buy you a drink? He asked. It's a little early for me, but I can always make an exception for a friend.
I shook my head. I should be getting back. I've got things to do. I limped back to Anchors and found the common room buzzing with excited folk talking about the fire in the fishery. Not wanting to answer any questions, I slunk into an out-of-the-way table and got one of the serving girls to bring me a bowl of soup and some bread. As I ate, my finely tuned eavesdropper's ears picked out pieces of the stories people were telling. It was only then, hearing it from other people, that I realized what I had done. I was used to people talking about me. As I've said, I had been actively building a reputation for myself. But this was different. This was real. People were already embroidering the details in confusing parts, but the heart of the story was still there. I had saved Fella, rushed into the fire and carried her to safety, just like Prince Gallant out of some storybook. It was my first taste of being a hero. I found it quite to my liking.
Chapter 67, A Matter of Hands. After lunch at Anchors, I decided to return to the fishery and see how much damage had been done. The stories I'd overheard implied that the fire had been brought under control fairly quickly. If that was the case, I might even be able to finish work on my blue emitters. If not, I might at least be able to reclaim my missing cloak. Surprisingly, the majority of the fishery made it through the fire without much damage at all, but the northeast quarter of the shop was practically destroyed. There was nothing left but a jumble of broken stone and glass and ash. Bright blurs of copper and silver spread over broken tabletops and portions of the floor where various metals had been melted by the heat of the fire. More unsettling than the wreckage was the fact that the workshop was deserted. I'd never seen the place empty before. I knocked on Kilvin's office door, then peered inside. Empty. That made a certain amount of sense. Without Kilvin, there was no one to organize the cleanup. Finishing the emitters took hours longer than I'd expected. My injuries distracted me, and my bandaged thumb made my hand slightly clumsy. As with most artificing, this job required two skilled hands. Even the minor encumbrance of a bandage was a serious inconvenience. Still, I finished the project without incident and was just preparing to test the emitters when I heard Kilvin in the hallway, cursing in Siaru. I glanced over my shoulder just in time to see him stomp through the doorway toward his office, followed by one of Master Arwill's gillers. I closed the fume hood and walked toward Kilvin's office, mindful of where I set my bare feet. Through the window, I could see Kilvin waving his arms like a farmer shooing crows. His hands were swathed in white bandages nearly to the elbow.
"Enough," he said. "I will tend them myself."
The man caught hold of one of Kilvin's arms and made adjustments to the bandages. Kilvin pulled his hands away and held them high in the air, out of reach.
"Linsatva! Enough is enough!"
The man said something too quiet for me to hear, but Kilvin continued to shake his head.
"No! And no more of your drugs! I have slept long enough!"
Kilvin motioned me inside.
"Ilir Kvoth! I need to speak to you!"
Not knowing what to expect, I stepped into his office. Kilvin gave me a dark look.
"Do you see what I find after the fire is quenched?"
he asked, gesturing toward a mass of dark cloth on his private work table. Kilvin lifted one corner of it carefully with a bandaged hand, and I recognized it as the charred remains of my cloak. Kilvin shook it once, sharply, and my hand lamp tumbled free, rolling awkwardly across the table.
"We spoke about your thieves' lamp not more than 2 days ago. Yet today, I find it lying about where anyone of questionable character might take it for their own."
He scowled at me.
"What do you have to say for yourself?"
I gaped. "I'm sorry, Master Kilvin. They took me away." He glanced at my feet, still scowling.
"And why are you unshod? Even an Ilir should have better sense than to wander naked-footed in a place such as this. Your behavior lately has been quite reckless. I am dismayed."
As I fumbled about for an explanation, Kilvin's grim expression spread into a sudden smile.
"I am joking with you, of course," he said gently. "I owe you a great weight of thanks for pulling Relar Fella from the fire today."
He reached out to pat me on the shoulder, then thought better of it when he remembered the bandages on his hand. I felt my body go limp with relief. I picked up the lamp and turned it over in my hand. It didn't seem to have been damaged by the fire or corroded by the bone tar. Kilvin brought out a small sack and laid on the table as well.
"These things were also in your cloak," he said. "Many things. Your pockets were full as a tinker's pack."
"You seem in a good mood, Master Kilvin," I said cautiously, wondering what painkiller he had been given at the Medica.
"I am," he said cheerfully. "Do you know the saying, Chen Van Eden Coat?"
I tried to puzzle it out. 7 years... I don't know coat.
"Expect disaster every 7 years," he said. "It's an old saying and true enough. This has been 2 years overdue."
He gestured to the wreckage of his shop with a bandaged hand.
"And now that it has come, it proves a mild disaster. My lamps were undamaged. No one was killed. Of all the small injuries, mine were the worst, as it should be."
I eyed his bandages, my stomach clenching at the thought of something happening to his skilled artificer's hands.
How are you?
I asked carefully.
Second-grade burns, he said,
then waved away my concerned exclamation before it hardly began.
Just blisters. Painful, but no charring. No long-term loss of mobility.
He gave an exasperated sigh.
Still, I will have a damn time getting any work done for the next 3 span.
If all you need is hands, I could lend them, Master Kilvin. He gave a respectful nod.
That is a generous offer, Elir. If it were merely a matter of hands, I would accept. But much of my work involved sigildry. That would be...
He paused, choosing his next words carefully.
Unwise for an Elir to have contact with.
Then you should promote me to Raylar, Master Kilvin, I said with a smile, so I might better serve you. He gave a deep chuckle.
I may at that, if you continue your good works.
I decided to change the subject rather than push my luck. What went wrong with the canister?
Too cold, Kilvin said. The metal was just a shell, protecting a glass container inside and keeping the temperature low. I suspect that the canister's sigildry was damaged, so it grew colder and colder. When the reagent froze...
I nodded, finally understanding. He cracked the inner glass container, like a bottle of beer when it freezes, then ate through the metal of the canister. Kilvin nodded.
Jexam is currently under the weight of my displeasure, he said darkly. He told me you brought it to his attention.
I was sure the whole building would burn to the ground, I said. I can't imagine how you managed to get it under control so easily.
Easily? He asked, sounding vaguely amused. Quickly, yes. But I did not know it was easily.
How did you manage it? He smiled at me.
Good question. How do you think?
Well, I heard one student say that you strode out of your office and called the fire's name, just like Taberlin the Great. You said, "Fire, be still," and the fire obeyed. Kilvin gave a great laugh.
I like that story, he said, grinning wildly behind his beard. But I have a question for you. How did you make it through the fire? The reagent produces a most intense flame. How is it you are not burned?
I used a drench to wet myself, Master Kilvin. Kilvin looked thoughtful.
Jexam saw you leaping through the fire just moments after the reagent spilled. The drench is quick, but not so quick as that.
I'm afraid I broke it, Master Kilvin. It seemed the only way. Kilvin squinted through the window of his office, frowned, then left and walked to the other end of the shop toward the shattered drench. Kneeling down, he picked up a jagged piece of glass between his bandaged fingers.
How in all the 4 corners did you manage to break my drench, Elir Quoth?
His tone was so puzzled that I actually laughed. Well, Master Kilvin, according to the students, I staved it in with a single blow from my mighty hand. Kilvin grinned again.
I like that story, too, but I do not believe it.
More reputable sources claim I used a piece of bar iron from a nearby table. Kilvin shook his head.
You are a fine boy, but this twice-tough glass was made by my own hands. Broad-shouldered Kemar could not break it with an anvil hammer.
He dropped a piece of glass and came back to his feet.
Let the others tell whatever stories they wish, but between us, let us share secrets.
It's no great mystery, I admitted. I know the sigildry for twice-tough glass. What I can make, I can break.
But where was your source? Kilvin said. You could have nothing ready on such short notice.
I held up my bandaged thumb.
Blood? He said, sounding surprised. Using the heat of your blood could be called reckless, Elir Quoth. What of binder's chills? What if you had gone into hypothermic shock?
My options were rather limited, Master Kilvin, I said. Kilvin nodded thoughtfully.
Quite impressive to unbind what I had wrought with nothing more than blood.
He started to run a hand through his beard,
then frowned in irritation when the bandages made this impossible. "What of you, Master Kilvin? How did you manage to get the fire under control?"
"Not using the name of fire," he conceded. "If Elodin had been here, matters would have been much simpler. But as the name of fire is unknown to me, I was left to my own devices."
I gave him a cautious look, not sure whether he was making another joke or not. Kilvin's deadpan humor was hard to detect at times. "Elodin knows the name of fire?" Kilvin nodded.
"There may be one or two others here at the university, but Elodin has the surest grip of it."
"The name of fire," I said slowly. "And they could have called it, and the fire would have done what they said, like Taberlin the Great?" Kilvin nodded again. "But those are just stories," I protested. He gave me an amused look.
"Where do you think the stories come from, Ilir Kvothe? Every tale has deep roots somewhere in the world."
"What sort of name is it? How does it work?" Kilvin hesitated for a moment, then shrugged his massive shoulders.
"It is troublesome to explain in this language. In any language. Ask Elodin. He makes a habit of studying such things."
I knew firsthand how helpful Elodin would be. "So how did you stop the fire?"
"There is little mystery in it," he said. "I was prepared for such an accident and had a small vial of the reagent in my office. I used it as a link and drew heat from the spill. The reagent grew too cold to boil and the remaining fog burned away. The lion's share of the reagent drained down the grates while Jackson and the others scattered lime and sand to control what was left."
"You can't be serious," I said. "It was a furnace in here. You couldn't have moved that many thalms of heat. Where would you have put it?"
"I had an empty heat eater ready for just such an emergency. Fire is the simplest of troubles I have prepared for."
I waved his expression aside. "Even so, there's no way. It must have been..." I tried to calculate how much heat he would have had to move, but stalled out, not knowing where to begin.
"I estimate 850 million thalms," Kilvin said. "Though we must check the trap for a more accurate number."
I was speechless. "But how?"
"Quickly."
He made a significant gesture with his bandaged hands.
"But not easily."
Chapter 68. The Ever-Changing Wind. I trudged through the next day barefoot, cloakless, and thinking grim thoughts about my life. The novelty of playing hero faded quickly in light of my situation. I had one ragged suit of clothes. My flash burns were minor but incessantly painful. I had no money to buy painkillers or new clothes. I chewed bitter willow bark, and bitter was my mood. My poverty hung around my neck like a heavy stone. Never before had I been more aware of the difference between myself and the other students. Everyone attending the university had a safety net to fall back on. Sim's parents were Aetor and nobility. Will came from a wealthy merchant family in the Shald. If things got rough for them, they could borrow against their family's credit or write a letter home. I, on the other hand, couldn't afford shoes. I only owned one shirt. How could I hope to stay in the university for the years it would take me to become a full arcanist? How could I hope to advance in the ranks without access to the archives? By noon, I had worked myself into such a grim mood that I snapped at Sim during lunch, and we bickered like an old married couple. Willem offered no opinion, keeping his eyes carefully on his food. Finally, in a blatant attempt to dispel my foul mood, they invited me to go see Three Pennies for Wishing across the river tomorrow evening. I agreed to go, as I heard the players were doing Feltemi's original and not one of the expurgated versions. It was well suited to my mood, full of dark humor, tragedy, and betrayal. After lunch, I found Kilvin had already sold half my emitters. Since they were going to be the last blue emitters made for some time, the price was high, and my share was slightly over a talent and a half. I expected Kilvin might have padded the price a little, which rankled my pride a bit, but I was in no position to look a gift horse in the mouth. But even this did nothing to improve my mood. Now I could afford shoes and a second-hand cloak. If I worked like a dog for the remainder of the term, I might be able to earn enough to eke out my interest to Debbie and tuition as well. The thought brought me no joy. More than ever, I was aware how tenuous my situation was. I was a hair's breadth away from disaster. My mood spiraled downward, and I skipped advanced sympathy in favor of going over the river to Imray. The thought of seeing Denna was the only thing that had the potential to raise my spirits a little. I still needed to explain to her why I'd missed our lunch date. On my way to the Aeolian, I bought a pair of low boots, good for walking and warm enough for the winter months ahead. It nearly emptied my purse again. I sullenly counted my money as I left the cobbler's shop. 3 jots and a drab. I'd had more money living on the streets of Tarbian.
"Your timing's good today," Diok said as I approached the Aeolian. "We've got someone waiting for you."
I felt a foolish grin spread to my face and clapped him on the shoulder as I headed inside. Instead of Denna, I spotted Fella sitting at a table by herself. Stanchion stood nearby, chatting with her. When he saw me approaching, he waved me over and wandered back to his usual perch at the bar, clapping me affectionately on the shoulder as he walked by. When she saw me, Fella came to her feet and rushed toward me. For a second, I thought she was going to run into my arms as if we were reunited lovers in some overacted Aeturan tragedy. But she pulled up short of that, her dark hair swinging. She was lovely as always, but with a heavy purpling bruise darkening one of her high cheekbones. "Oh, no," I said, my hand going to my face in sympathetic pain. "Is that from when I dropped you? I'm so sorry." She gave me an incredulous look, then burst out laughing. "You're apologizing for pulling me out of a fiery hell?" "Just the part where I passed out and dropped you. It was sheer stupidity. I forgot to hold my breath and suck down some bad air. Were you hurt anywhere else?" "Nowhere I can show you in public," she said with a slight grimace, shifting her hips in a way I found most distracting. "Nothing too bad, I hope." She put on a fierce expression. "Yes, well, I expect you to do a better job next time. A girl gets her life saved, she expects gentler treatment all around." "Fair enough," I said, relaxing. "We'll treat this as a practice run." There was a heartbeat of silence between us, and Fella's smile faded a bit. She reached out halfway to me with one hand, then hesitated and let it fall back to her side. "Seriously, Quoth, that was the worst moment of my whole life. There was fire everywhere." She looked down, blinking. "I knew I was going to die. I really knew it. But I just stood there like some scared rabbit." She looked up, blinking away tears, and her smile burst out again, dazzling as ever. "Then you were there, running through the fire. It was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. It was like... Have you ever seen Deonica?" I nodded and smiled. "It was like watching Tarsus bursting out of hell. You came through the fire, and I knew everything was going to be all right." She took a half step toward me and rested her hand on my arm. I could feel the warmth of it through my shirt. "I was going to die there," she broke off, embarrassed. "I'm just repeating myself now." I shook my head. "That's not true. I saw you. You were looking for a way out." "No, I was just standing there, like one of those silly girls in those stories my mother used to read to me. I always hated them. I used to ask, why doesn't she just push the witch out the window? Why doesn't she poison the ogre's food?" Fella was looking down at her feet now, her hair falling to hide her face. Her voice grew softer and softer until it was barely louder than a sigh. "Why does she just sit there waiting to be saved? Why doesn't she save herself?" I lay my hand on top of hers in what I hoped was a comforting way. When I did, I noticed something. Her hand wasn't the delicate, fragile thing I had expected.
It was strong and calloused. A sculptor's hand that knew hard hours of work with hammer and chisel. "This isn't a maiden's hand," I said. She looked up at me, her eyes luminous with the beginning of tears. She gave a startled laugh that was half sob.
What?
I flushed with embarrassment as I realized what I'd said, but pushed ahead. "This isn't the hand of some swooning princess who sits tatting lace and waiting for some prince to save her. This is the hand of a woman who would climb a rope of her own hair to freedom, or kill a captor ogre in his sleep." I looked into her eyes. "And this is the hand of a woman who would have made it through the fire on her own if I hadn't been there. Singed, perhaps, but safe." I brought her hand to my lips and kissed it. It seemed like the thing to do. "All the same, I am glad I was there to help," I smiled.
"So, like Tarsus?"
Her smile dazzled me again. "Like Tarsus, Prince Gallant, and Orin Velsiter all rolled into one," she said, laughing. She gripped my hand. "Come see. I have something for you." Fella pulled me back to the table where she'd been sitting and handed me a bundle of cloth. "I asked Will and Sim what I could get you as a gift, and it seemed somehow appropriate." She paused, suddenly shy. "It was a cloak. It was a deep forest green, rich cloth, fine cut. It hadn't been bought off the back of some fripperer's cart, either. This was the sort of clothing I could never hope to afford for myself." "I had the tailor sew a bunch of little pockets into it," she said nervously. "Will and Sim both mentioned how that was important." "It's lovely," I said. Her smile beamed out again. "I had to guess at the measurements," she admitted. "Let's see if it fits." She took the cloak out of my hands and stepped close to me, spreading it over my shoulders, her arms circling me in something very near to an embrace. I stood there, to use Fella's words, like a scared rabbit. She was close enough that I could feel the warmth of her, and when she leaned to adjust the way the cloak lay across my shoulder, one of her breasts brushed my arm. I stood still as a statue. Over Fella's shoulder, I saw Diok grin from where he leaned in the doorway across the room. Fella stepped back, eyed me critically, then stepped close again and made a small adjustment to the way the cloak fastened across my chest. "It suits you," she said. "The color brings out your eyes. Not that they need it. They're the greenest thing I've seen today. Like a piece of spring." As Fella stepped back to admire her handiwork, I saw a familiar shape leaving the Aeolian through the front door. Denna. I only caught a brief glimpse of her profile, but I recognized her as surely as I know the backs of my own hands. What she had seen and what conclusions she had drawn from it, I could only guess. My first impulse was to bolt out the door after her, to explain why I had broken our date 2 days ago, to say I was sorry, to make it clear that the woman with her arms around me had just been giving me a gift, nothing more. Fella smoothed the cloak over my shoulder and looked at me with eyes that only moments before had been luminous with the beginnings of tears. "It fits perfectly," I said, taking the cloth between my fingers and fanning it out to the side. "It's much better than I deserve, and you shouldn't have, but I thank you. I wanted to show you how much I appreciated what you did." She reached out to touch my arm again. "This is nothing, really. If there's anything I can ever do for you, any favor, you should stop by." She paused, looking at me quizzically. "Are you all right?" I glanced past her toward the doorway. Denna could be anywhere by now. I'd never be able to catch her. "I'm fine," I lied. Fella bought me a drink, and we chatted for a while about small things. I was surprised to learn that she'd been working with Elodin for the last several months. She did some sculpting for him, and in exchange, he occasionally tried to teach her. She rolled her eyes. He woke her in the middle of the night and took her to an abandoned quarry north of town.
He put wet clay in her shoes and made her spend the entire day walking around in them. He even... She flushed and shook her head, breaking off the story. Curious but not wanting to make her uncomfortable, I didn't pursue it any further, and we agreed between the two of us that he was more than half mad. All the while I sat facing the door, vainly hoping that Denna might return and I could explain the truth of matters to her. Eventually, Fella headed back to the university for abstract maths. I stayed at the Aeolian, nursing a drink and trying to think how I could make things right between Denna and myself. I would have liked to have had a good, maudlin drunk, but I couldn't afford it. So I made my slow, limping way back across the river as the sun was setting. It wasn't until I was getting ready to make one of my regular trips to the roof of Maine's that I realized the significance of something Kilvin had said to me. If the majority of the bone tar had gone down the grates... Ari. She lived in the tunnels underneath the university. I bolted to the Medica, moving as quickly as I could despite my weary, footsore state. Halfway there, I had a stroke of luck and spotted Mola crossing the courtyard. I shouted and waved to get her attention. Mola eyed me suspiciously as I approached. "You're not going to serenade me, are you?" I shifted my lute self-consciously and shook my head. "I need a favor," I said. "I have a friend that might be hurt." She gave a weary sigh. "You should..." "I can't go to the Medica for help." I let my anxiety creep into my voice. "Please, Mola. I promise it won't take more than a half hour or so, but we have to go now. I'm worried I might be too late already." Something in my tone convinced her. "What's the matter with your friend?" "Maybe burns, maybe acid, maybe smoke. Like the people who were caught in the fishery fire yesterday. Maybe worse." Mola started walking. "I'll get my kit from my room." "I'll wait here if you don't mind." I took a seat on a nearby bench. "I'll just slow you down." I sat and tried to ignore my various burns and bruises, and when Mola returned, I led her to the southwestern side of Maine's, where there were a trio of decorative chimneys. "We can use these to get on the roof." She gave me a curious look, but seemed content to hold on to her questions for now. I made my slow way up the chimney, using the protruding pieces of fieldstone as hand and footholds. This was one of the easiest ways onto the roof of Maine's. I'd chosen it partly because I wasn't sure of Mola's climbing ability, and partly because my own injuries had left me feeling less than athletic. Mola joined me on the roof. She still wore her dark uniform from the Medica, but had added a gray cloak from her room. I took a roundabout path so we could stay on the safer sections of Maine's. It was a cloudless night, and there was a sliver of moon to light our way. "If I didn't know better," Mola said as we made our way around a tall brick chimney, "I'd think that you were luring me somewhere quiet for a sinister purpose." "What makes you think that I'm not?" I asked lightly. "You don't seem like the type," she said. "Besides, you can barely walk. If you tried anything, I'd just push you off the roof." "Don't spare my feelings," I said with a chuckle. "Even if I weren't half crippled, you could still throw me off this roof." I stumbled a little on an unseen ridge and nearly fell because my battered body was slow to respond. I sat on a piece of roof slightly higher than the rest and waited for the momentary dizziness to pass. "Are you all right?" Mola asked. "Probably not." I pushed myself to my feet. "It's just over this next roof," I said. "It might be best if you stood back a ways and stayed quiet, just in case." I made my way to the edge of the roof. I looked down at the hedges and the apple tree. The windows were dark. "Ari," I called softly. "Are you there?" I waited, growing more nervous by the second. "Ari, are you hurt?" "Nothing." I began to curse under my breath. Mola crossed her arms. "Right, I think I've been plenty patient here. Care to tell me what's going on?" "Follow me and I'll explain." I headed for the apple tree and began to climb carefully down. I walked around the hedge to the iron grate. The ammonia smell of bone tar wafted up from the grate, faint but persistent. I tugged on the grate and it lifted a few inches before catching on something. "I made a friend a few months ago,"
I said, nervously sliding my hand between the bars. She lives down here. I'm worried that she might be hurt. A lot of the reagent went down the drains from the fishery. Mola was silent for a while. You're serious? I felt around in the dark under the grate, trying to figure out how Ari kept it closed. What sort of person would live down there? A frightened person, I said. A person who's afraid of loud noises and people and the open sky. It took me nearly a month to coax her out of the tunnels, let alone get close enough to talk. Mola sighed. If you don't mind, I'll have a seat. She walked over to the bench. I've been on my feet all day. I continued to feel around under the grate, but try as I might, I couldn't find a clasp anywhere. Growing increasingly frustrated, I grabbed the grate and tugged on it hard, again and again. It made several echoing metallic thumps, but didn't come free. Quoth? I looked up to the edge of the roof and saw Ari standing there, a silhouette against the night sky, her fine hair made a cloud around her head. Ari! The tension poured out of me, leaving me feeling weak and rubbery. Where have you been? There were clouds, she said simply as she walked around the edge of the roof toward the apple tree. So I went looking for you on top of things. But the moon's coming out, so I came back. Ari scampered down the tree, then pulled up short when she saw Mola's cloaked form sitting on the bench. I brought a friend to visit, Ari, I said in my gentlest tones. I hope you don't mind. There was a long pause. Is he nice? It's a she, and yes, she's nice. Ari relaxed a bit and came a few steps closer to me. I brought you a feather with a spring wind on it, but since you were late... She looked at me gravely. You get a coin instead. She held it out at arm's length, pinched between her thumb and forefinger. It will keep you safe at night, as much as anything can, that is. It was shaped like an Aeturan penance piece, but it gleamed silver in the moonlight. I'd never seen a coin like it. Kneeling, I opened my loot case and brought out a small bundle. I've got some tomatoes, beans, and something special. I held out the small sack I'd spent most of my money on 2 days ago, before all my troubles had started. Sea salt. Ari took it and peered inside the small leather sack. Why, this is lovely, Quoth. What lives in the salt? Trace minerals, I thought. Chromium, basalt, malium, iodine. Everything your body needs but probably can't get from apples and bread and whatever you manage to scrounge up when I can't find you. The dreams of fish, I said, and sailors' songs. Ari nodded, satisfied, and sat down, spreading out the small cloth and arranging her food with the same care as always. I watched her as she began to eat, dipping a green bean into the salt before taking a bite. She didn't seem hurt, but it was hard to tell by the pale moonlight. I needed to be sure. Are you okay, Ari? She cocked her head at me, curious. There was a big fire. A lot of it went down the grates. Did you see it? Holy God, yes, she said, her eyes wide. It was all over, and all the shrews and raccoons were running everywhere, trying to get out. Did any of it get on you? I asked. Did you get burned? She shook her head, grinning a child's sly smile. Oh, no. It couldn't catch me. Were you close to the fire? I asked. Did you breathe any of the smoke? Why would I breathe smoke? Ari looked at me as if I were simple. The whole underthing smells like cat piss now. She wrinkled her nose. Except by downing, and in the belows. I relaxed a bit, but I saw Mola began to fidget where she was sitting on the bench. Ari, can my friend come over? Ari froze with a bean halfway to her mouth, then relaxed and bobbed her head once, sending her fine hair swirling around her. I beckoned to Mola, who began to walk slowly toward us. I was a little uneasy at how their meeting would go. It had taken me over a month of gentle coaxing to draw Ari out from the tunnels underneath the university where she lived. I worried that a bad reaction from Mola might startle her back underground, where I would have no chance of finding her. I gestured to where Mola stood. "This is my friend, Mola."
"Hello, Mola."
Ari looked up and smiled.
"You have sunny hair like me. Would you like an apple?"
Mola's expression was carefully blank.
"Thank you, Ari. I'd like that."
Ari jumped up and ran back to where the apple tree overhung the edge of the roof, then ran back toward us, her hair flying behind her like a flag. She handed Mola an apple.
"This one has a wish inside it," she said matter-of-factly. "Make sure you know what you want before you take a bite."
That said, she settled back down and ate another bean, chewing primly. Mola looked over the apple for a long moment before taking a bite. Ari finished her meal quickly after that and tied up the bag of salt.
"Now play," she said excited. "Play!"
Smiling, I brought out my lute and brushed my hands over the strings. Thankfully, my injured thumb was on my cording hand, where it would be a relatively minor inconvenience. I looked at Mola as I turned the strings. "You can go if you like," I told her. "I wouldn't want to accidentally serenade you."
"Oh, you mustn't go!"
Ari turned to Mola, her expression deathly serious.
"His voice is like a thunderstorm, and his hands know every secret hidden deep beneath the cool, dark earth."
Mola's mouth quirked into a smile. "I suppose I could stay for that." So I played for both of them, while overhead the stars continued in their measured turning.
"Why haven't you told anyone?"
Mola asked me as we made our way across the rooftops.
"It didn't seem like anyone's business," I said. "If she wanted people to know she was there, I imagine she'd tell them herself."
"You know what I mean," Mola said, irritated.
"I know what you mean," I sighed.
"But what good would come of it?
She's happy where she is."
"Happy?" Mola sounded incredulous. "She's ragged and half-starved. She needs help. Food and clothes."
"I bring her food," I said. "And I'll bring her clothes, too, as soon—"
I hesitated, not wanting to admit my abject poverty, at least not in so many words.
"As soon as I can manage it."
"Why wait? If you just told someone—"
"Right," I said sarcastically. "I'm sure Jameson would rush out here with a box of chocolates and a feather bed if he knew there was a starveling half-crack student living under his university. They'd crock her, and you know it."
"Not necessarily." She didn't even bother finishing, knowing what I'd said was true.
"Mola, if people come looking for her, she'll just rabbit down into the tunnels. They'll scare her away, and I'll lose what chance I have to help her."
Mola looked down at me, her arms folded across her chest.
"Fine. For now. But you'll have to bring me back here later. I'll bring her some of my clothes. They'll be too big for her, but they'll be better than what she has."
I shook my head. "It won't work. I brought her a second-hand dress a couple span ago. She says wearing someone else's clothes is filthy."
Mola looked puzzled.
"She didn't look Sealedish.
Not even a little.
Maybe she was just raised that way."
"Do you feel any better?"
"Yes," I lied.
"You're shaking."
She stretched out a hand. "Here, lean on me." Pulling my new cloak close around me, I took her arm and made my slow way back to Anchors. Chapter 69. Wind or Women's Fancy. Over the next two span, my new cloak kept me warm on my occasional walks to Imre, where I was consistently unsuccessful in finding Denna. I always had some reason to cross the river, borrowing a book from Devi, meeting Threp for lunch, playing at the Aeolian, but Denna was the real reason. Kilvin sold the rest of my emitters, and my mood improved as my burns healed. I had money to spare for luxuries such as soap and a second shirt to replace the one I'd lost. Today, I had gone to Imre for some basal filings I needed for my current project, a large sympathy lamp using two emitters I'd saved for myself. I hoped to turn a tidy profit. It may seem odd that I was constantly buying materials for my artificing over the river,
But the truth was, merchants near the university frequently took advantage of the students' laziness and raised their prices. It was worth the walk for me if I could save a couple of pennies. After I finished my errand, I headed to the Aeolian. Diok was at his usual post, leaning against the doorway.
"I've been keeping an eye out for your girl," he said.
Irritated at how transparent I must seem, I muttered, "She's not my girl." Diok rolled his eyes.
"Fine. The girl. Denna, Diane, Diane, whatever she's calling herself these days. I haven't seen hide nor hair of her. I even asked around a little. Nobody's seen her in a full span. That means she's probably left town. It's her way. She does it at the drop of a hat."
I tried not to let my disappointment show. "You didn't have to go to the trouble," I said. "But thanks all the same."
"I wasn't asking entirely on your account," Diok admitted. "I've a fondness for her myself."
"Do you now?" I said as neutrally as I could manage.
"Don't give me that look. I'm not any sort of competition."
He gave a crooked smile. "Not this time around, at any rate.
I might not be one of you university folk, but I can see the moon on a clear night. I'm smart enough not to stick my hand in the same fire twice."
I struggled to get my expression back under control, more than slightly embarrassed. I don't usually let my emotions go parading around on my face.
"So you and Denna?" "Stanchion still gives me a hard time about chasing after a girl half my age."
He shrugged his broad shoulders sheepishly.
"For all that, I am still fond of her. These days she reminds me of my littlest sister more than anything."
"How long have you known her?" I asked, curious.
"I wouldn't say I really know her, lad. But I met her, what, about 2 years back? Not that long. Maybe a year and a little change."
Diok ran both of his hands through his blonde hair and arched his back in a great stretch, the muscles in his arms straining against his shirt. Then he relaxed with an explosive sigh and looked out at the nearly empty courtyard.
"The door won't be busy for hours yet. Come, give an old man an excuse to sit and have a drink."
He jerked his head in the direction of the bar. I looked at Diok, tall, muscular, and tan. "Old man? You've still got all your hair and your teeth, don't you? What are you, 30?
"Nothing makes a man feel older than a young woman."
He laid a hand on my shoulder.
"Come on, share a drink with me."
We made our way over to the long mahogany bar, and he muttered as he looked over the bottles.
"Beer dulls a memory. Brand sets it burning. But wine is best for a sore heart's yearning."
He paused and turned to look at me, his brow furrowed.
"I can't remember the rest of that. Can you?"
"Never heard it before," I said. "But Tekum claims that out of all the spirits, only wine is suited to reminiscence. He said a good wine allows clarity and focus, while still allowing a bit of comforting coloration of the memory."
"Fair enough,"
he said, picking through the racks before drawing out a bottle and holding it up to a lamp, peering through it.
"Let's view her in a rosy light, shall we?"
He grabbed two glasses and led us off to a secluded booth in the corner of the room. "So, you've known Denna for a while," I prompted as he poured each of us a glass of pale red wine. He slouched back against the wall.
"Off and on. More off, honestly."
"What was she like back then?" Diok spent several long moments pondering his answer, giving the question more serious consideration than I'd expected. He sipped his wine.
"The same," he said at last. "I suppose she was younger, but I can't say she seems any older now. She always struck me as being older than her years."
He frowned.
"Not old, really. More
mature?" I suggested. He shook his head.
"No.
I don't know a good word for it. It's like if you look at a great oak tree. You don't appreciate it because it's older than the other trees, or because it's taller. It just has something that the other younger trees don't. Complexity, solidity, significance. Diak scowled, irritated. Damn if that isn't the worst comparison I've ever made. A smile broke onto my face. It's nice to see I'm not the only one who has trouble pinning her down with words.
She's not much for being pinned down, Diak agreed and drank off the rest of his wine.
He picked up the bottle and tapped the mouth of it lightly against my glass. I emptied it, and he poured again for both of us. Diak continued.
She was just as restless then, and wild, just as pretty, prone to startle the eye and stutter the heart.
He shrugged again.
As I said, largely the same. Lovely voice, light of foot, quick of tongue, men's adoration and woman's scorn in roughly equal amounts.
Scorn? I asked. Diak looked at me as if he didn't understand what I was asking.
Women hate Denna,
he said plainly, as if repeating something we both already knew.
Hate her?
The thought baffled me.
Why?
Diak looked at me incredulously, then burst out laughing.
Good Lord, you really don't know anything about women, do you?
I would ordinarily have bristled at his comment, but Diak was nothing but good-natured.
Think of it. She's pretty and charming. Men crowd around her like stags in a rut.
He made a flippant gesture.
Women are bound to resent it.
I remembered what Sim had said about Diak not a span ago. He's managed to get the most beautiful woman in the place again. It's enough to make you hate a man. I've always felt she was rather lonely, I volunteered. Maybe that's why. Diak nodded solemnly.
There's truth to that. I never see her in the company of other women folk, and she has about as much luck with men as...
He paused, groping for a comparison.
As...
Damn! He gave a frustrated sigh. Well, you know what they say. Finding the right analogy is as hard as... I put on a thoughtful expression. As hard as... I made an inarticulate, grasping gesture. Diak laughed and poured more wine for both of us. I began to relax. There is a sort of camaraderie that rarely exists except between men who have fought the same enemies and known the same women.
Did she tend to disappear back then, too? I asked.
He nodded.
No warning, just suddenly gone. Sometimes for a span, sometimes for months.
No fickleness in flight like that of wind or woman's fancy, I quoted. I meant it to be musing, but it came out bitter. Do you have any guess as to why?
I've given some thought to that, Diak said philosophically. In part, I think it's her nature. It could be she simply has wandering blood.
My irritation cooled a bit at his words. Back in my troop, my father occasionally made us pull up stakes and leave a town despite the fact that we were welcome and the crowds were generous. Later, he would often explain his reasoning to me. A glare from the constable, too many fond sighs from the young wives in town. But sometimes he had no reason.
We Ru are meant to travel, son. When my blood tells me to wander, I know enough to trust it. Her circumstances are probably responsible for most of it, Diak continued.
Circumstances? I asked, curious. She never talked of her past when we were together, and I was always careful not to press her. I knew what it was like, not wanting to talk too much about your past.
Well... She doesn't have any family or means of support, no long-standing friends able to help her out of a tight spot if the need arises.
I haven't got any of those things either, I groused, the wine making me a little surly.
There's more than a little difference there, Diak said with a hint of reproach. A man has a great many opportunities to make his way in the world. You found yourself a place at the university.
and if you hadn't, you would still have options.
He looked at me with a knowing eye.
What options are available to a young, pretty girl with no family, no dowry, no home?
He began to hold up fingers.
There's begging and whoring, or being some lord's mistress, which is a different slice of the same loaf. And we know our Denna doesn't have it in her to be a kept woman or someone's dox.
There's other work to be had, I said, holding up fingers of my own. Seamstress, weaver, serving girl. Diok snorted and gave me a disgusted look.
Come now, lad, you're smarter than that. You know what those places are like. And you know that a pretty girl with no family ends up being taken advantage of just as often as a whore, and paid less for her trouble.
I flushed a bit at his rebuke, more than I would have normally, as I was feeling the wine. It was making my lips and the tips of my fingers a little numb.
Diok filled our glasses again. She's not to be looked down on for moving where the wind blows her. She has to take her opportunities where she finds them. If she gets the chance to travel with some folk who like her singing, or with a merchant who hopes her pretty face will help him sell his wares, who's to blame her for pulling up stakes and leaving town? And if she trades on her charm a bit, I'll not look down on her because of it. Young gents court her, buy her presents, dresses, jewelry.
He shrugged his broad shoulders.
If she sells those things for money to live, there's nothing wrong with that. They are gifts freely given, and hers to do with as she pleases.
Diok fixed me with a stare.
But what is she to do when some gent gets too familiar, or gets angry at being denied what he considers bought and paid for? What recourse does she have? No family, no friends, no standing, no choice. None but to give herself over to him, all unwilling.
Diok's face was grim.
Or to leave. Leave quickly and find better weather. Is it any surprise, then, that she is harder to lay hands on than a wind-blown leaf?
He shook his head, looking down at the table.
No, I do not envy her her life, nor do I judge her.
His tirade seemed to have left him spent and slightly embarrassed. He didn't look up at me as he spoke.
For all that, I would help her, if she would let me.
He glanced up at me and gave a chagrined smile.
But she's not the sort to be beholden to anyone. Not one whit, not a hair's breadth.
He sighed and dribbled the last drops of the bottle evenly into our glasses.
You've shown her to me in a new light, I said honestly. I'm ashamed I didn't see it for myself.
Well, I've had a head start on you, he said easily. I've known her longer.
Nevertheless, I thank you,
I said, holding up my glass.
He held up his own. To Diane, he said, most lovely. To Denna, full of delight. Young and unbending. Bright and fair. Ever sought, ever alone. So wise and so foolish, I said. So merry and so sad. Gods of my fathers,
Diok said reverently,
keep her always so, unchanging, past my understanding and safe from harm.
We both drank and set down our glasses. Let me buy the next bottle, I said. It would tap out my slowly hoarded line of credit with the bar, but I found myself increasingly fond of Diok, and the thought of not standing my round with him was too galling to consider.
Stream, stone, and sky, he swore, rubbing at his face. I dare not. Another bottle, and we'd be slitting our wrists into the river before the sun goes down.
I made a gesture to a serving girl. Nonsense, I said. We'll just change to something less maudlin than wine. I didn't notice I was being followed when I returned to the university. Perhaps my head was so full of Denna that there was little room left for anything else. Perhaps I had been living civilized for so long that the hard-earned reflexes I'd picked up in Tarbian were starting to fade. The Blackberry brand probably had something to do with it as well.
Diak and I had talked for a long while, and between us, drank half a bottle of the stuff. I had brought the remainder of the bottle back with me, as I knew Simon had a taste for it. Small matter why I didn't notice them, I suppose. The result was the same. I was strolling down a poorly lit part of Newhall Lane, when something blunt struck me on the back of the head, and I was bundled off into a nearby alley, half senseless. I was only stunned for a moment, but by the time I had regathered my wits, I had a heavy hand clamped over my mouth.
"All right, Cully,"
the huge man behind me spoke into my ear.
"I've got a knife on you. You struggle, I stick you. That's all there is to it."
I felt a gentle prod against my ribs under my left arm.
"Check the finder,"
he said to his companion. A tall shape was all I could see in the dim light of the alley. He bowed his head, looking at his hand.
"I can't tell."
"Light a match, then. We have to be sure."
My anxiety began to blossom into full-blown panic. This wasn't some back-alley coshing. They hadn't even checked my pockets for money. This was something else.
"We know it's him,"
the tall one said impatiently.
"Let's just do this and have it over with. I'm cold."
"Like hell. Check it now while he's close. We've lost him twice already. I'm not having another cock-up like in Annalyn."
"I hate this thing,"
the tall man said as he went through his pockets, presumably looking for a match.
"You're an idiot," the one behind me said. "It's cleaner this way. Simpler. No confusing descriptions, no names, no worrying about disguises. Follow the needle, find our man, and have done with it."
The matter-of-fact tone of their voices terrified me. These men were professionals. I realized with sudden certainty that Ambrose had finally taken steps to ensure I would never bother him again. My mind raced for a moment, and I did the only thing I could think of. I dropped the half-full bottle of brand. It shattered on the cobblestones, and the night air was suddenly filled with the smell of blackberries.
"That's great," the tall man hissed. "How about you let him ring a bell while you're at it?"
The man behind me tightened his grip on my neck and shook me hard just once, the same way you would do to a naughty puppy.
"None of that," he said, irritated.
I went limp, hoping to lull him, then concentrated and muttered a binding against the man's thick hand.
"Tough tits," the man replied. "If you stepped in glass, it's your own damn fault."
He let out a startled shout as the pool of brand around our feet caught fire. I took advantage of his momentary distraction and twisted away from him, but I wasn't quite quick enough. His knife tore a bright line of pain across my ribs as I pulled away and began pelting down the alley. But my flight was short-lived. The alley dead-ended against a sheer brick wall. There were no doors, no windows, nothing to hide behind or use to get a leg up on the wall. I was trapped. I turned to see the two men blocking the mouth of the alley. The large one was stamping his leg furiously, trying to extinguish it. My left leg was burning as well, but I didn't spare a thought for it. A little burn would be the least of my problems if I didn't do something quick. I looked around again, but the alley was distressingly clean. Not even any decent garbage to use as a makeshift weapon. I frantically ran through the contents of my cloak's pockets, desperately trying to form some sort of plan. Some pieces of copper wire were useless. Salts, could I throw in their eyes? No. Dried apple, pen and ink, a marble, string, wax. The large man finally beat out the flames, and the two of them began to make their slow way down the alley. The light from the circle of burning brand flickered across the blades of their knives. Still going over my countless pockets, I found a lump that I didn't recognize. Then I remembered. It was the sack of Bassol shavings I had bought to use for my sympathy lamp. Bassol is a light, silvery metal used in certain alloys that I would be using to construct my lamp. Manette, ever the careful teacher, had taken care to describe the dangers of every material we used. If it gets hot enough, basalt burns with an intense, white-hot flame. I hurriedly untied the pouch. The trouble was, I didn't know if I could make this work. Things like candle wicking or alcohol are easy to light. They just need a focused flash of heat to get them going. Basol was different. It needed a great deal of heat to ignite, which is why I wasn't worried about carrying it around in my pocket. The men came a few slow steps closer, and I flung the handful of basol shavings in a wide arc. I tried to get it close to their faces, but didn't hold much hope. The shavings had no real heft. It was like throwing a handful of loose snow. Lowering one hand to the flame licking at my leg, I focused my ailer. The wide pool of burning brand winked out behind the two men, leaving the alley in pitch darkness, but there still wasn't enough heat. Reckless with desperation, I touched my bloody side, concentrated, and felt a terrible cold tear through me as I pulled more heat from my blood. There was an explosion of white light, blinding in the dark of the alley. I'd closed my eyes, but even through my lids, the burning basol was piercingly bright. One of the men screamed, high and terrified. When I opened my eyes, I could see nothing but blue ghosts dancing over my vision. The scream faded to a low moaning, and I heard a thump as if one of the men had stumbled and fallen. The tall man began to babble, his voice little more than a terrified sobbing.
Oh, God! Damn, my eyes! I'm blind!
As I listened, my vision cleared enough for me to see the vague outlines of the alley. I could see the dark shapes of both men. One was kneeling with his hands in front of his face. The other was sprawled motionless on the ground farther down the alley. It looked like he had run headlong into a low rafter beam at the mouth of the alley and knocked himself unconscious. Scattered around the cobblestones, the remnants of basol were sputtering out like tiny blue-white stars. The kneeling man was only flash-blind, but it would last for several minutes, long enough for me to get well away from here. I moved slowly around him, being careful to step quietly. My heart leapt into my throat as he spoke up again.
Tam?
The man's voice was high and frightened.
I swear, Tam, I'm blind! The kid called down lightning on me!
I saw him go down onto all fours and begin to feel around with his hands.
You were right. We shouldn't have come here. No good comes of meddling with these sort of folk.
Lightning. Of course. He didn't know a thing about real magic. It gave me a thought. I took a deep breath, settling my nerves.
Who sent you?
I demanded in my best Taberlin the Great voice. It wasn't as good as my father's, but it was good. The big man gave a wretched moan and stopped feeling around with his hands.
Oh, sir, don't do anything.
I'm not asking again,
I cut him off angrily.
Tell me who sent you, and if you lie to me, I'll know.
I don't know a name, he said quickly. We just get half the coin and a hair. We don't know names. We don't actually meet, I swear.
A hare. The thing they had called a finder was probably some sort of dowsing compass. Though I couldn't make anything that advanced, I knew the principles involved. With a piece of my hair, it would point toward me no matter where I ran.
If I ever see either of you again, I will call down worse than fire and lightning,
I said menacingly as I edged toward the mouth of the alley. If I could get hold of their finder, I wouldn't have to worry about them tracking me down again. It had been dark, and the hood of my cloak had been up. They might not even know what I looked like.
Thank you, sir, he babbled. I swear you won't see hide or hair of us after this. Thank you.
I looked down at the fallen man. I could see one of his pale hands against the cobblestones, but it was empty. I looked around, wondering if he had dropped it. It was more likely that he'd tucked it away. I moved closer still, holding my breath. I reached into his cloak, feeling for pockets, but his cloak was pinned under his body. I took gentle hold of his shoulder and eased him slowly. Just then, he let out a low moan and rolled the rest of the way onto his back under his own power. His arm flopped loosely onto the cobbles, bumping my leg. I would like to say I simply took a step away, knowing that the tall man would be groggy and still half-blind. I'd like to tell you I remained calm and did my best to intimidate them further, or at the very least, that I said something dramatic or witty before I left. But that would not be the truth. The truth was, I ran like a frightened deer. I made it nearly a quarter of a mile before the darkness and my dazzled vision betrayed me, and I ran headlong into a horse tether, crumpling to the ground in a painful heap. Bruised, bleeding, and half-blind, I lay there. Only then did I realize I wasn't being chased at all. I dragged myself to my feet, cursing myself for a fool. If I'd kept my wits about me, I could have taken their dowsing compass away, ensuring my safety. As it was, I'd have to take other precautions. I made my way back to Anchors, but when I arrived, all the inn's windows were dark and the door was locked. So, half drunk and wounded, I made my way up to my window, tripped the latch, and tugged. But it wouldn't open. It had been at least a span of days since I'd come back to the inn so late that I'd been forced to use my window route. Had the hinges rusted? Bracing myself against the wall, I drew out my hand lamp and thumbed it on to its dimmest setting. Only then did I see something lodged firmly into the crack of the window frame. Had Anchors wedged my window shut? But when I touched it, I realized it wasn't wood. It was a piece of paper, much folded over. I tugged it free, and the window came open easily. I clambered inside. My shirt was ruined, but when I stripped it off, I was relieved by what I saw. The cut wasn't particularly deep, painful and messy, but less serious than when I'd been whipped. Fella's cloak was torn too, which was irritating. But, everything said, it would be easier to patch that than my kidney. I made a mental note to thank Fella for choosing a nice, thick fabric. Stitching it up could wait. For all I knew, the two men had recovered from the little scare I'd given them and were already dousing for me again. I left through the window, leaving my cloak behind so as not to get any blood on it. I hoped the lateness of the hour and my natural stealth would keep me from being seen. I couldn't begin to guess what rumors would start if someone saw me running across the rooftops late at night, bloody and naked to the waist. I gathered up a handful of leaves as I made my way to the roof of a livery overlooking the pennant courtyard near the archives. In the dim moonlight, I could see the dark, shapeless shadows of leaves swirling over the gray of the cobblestones below. I ran my hand roughly through my hair, ending up with a few loose strands. Then I dug at a seam of tar on the roof with my fingernails and used some to stick the hair to a leaf. I repeated this a dozen times, dropping the leaves off the roof, watching as the wind took them away in a mad dance back and forth across the courtyard. I smiled at the thought of anyone trying to douse for me now, trying to make sense of the dozens of contradictory signals as the leaves swirled and spun in a dozen different directions. I'd come to this particular courtyard because the wind moved oddly here. I'd only noticed it after the autumn leaves began to fall. They moved in a complex, chaotic dance across the cobblestones, first one way, then another, never falling into a predictable pattern. Once you noticed the wind's odd swirlings, it was hard to ignore. In fact, viewed from the roof like this, it was almost hypnotic, the same way flowing water or a campfire's flames can catch your eye and hold it. Watching it tonight, weary and wounded, it was rather relaxing. The more I watched it, the less chaotic it seemed. In fact, I began to sense a greater underlying pattern to the way the wind moved through the courtyard. It only looked chaotic because it was vastly, marvelously complex. What's more, it seemed to be always changing. It was a pattern made of changing patterns. It was, "You're up studying awfully late," said a quiet voice from behind me. Startled out of my reverie, my body tensed, ready to bolt. How had someone managed to get up here without my noticing? It was Elodin. Master Elodin. He was dressed in a patched set of pants and a loose shirt. He waved idly in my direction and crouched down to sit cross-legged on the edge of the roof as casually as if we were meeting for a drink in a pub. He looked down into the courtyard. "It's particularly good tonight, isn't it?" I folded my arms, ineffectually trying to cover my bare, bloody chest. Only then did I notice the blood on my hands was dry. How long had I been sitting here motionless, watching the wind? "Master Elodin," I said,
then stopped. I had no idea what I could possibly say in a situation like this.
"Please, we're all friends here. Feel free to call me by my first name, Master."
He gave a lazy grin and looked back down toward the courtyard. Hadn't he noticed the state I was in? Was he being polite? Maybe. I shook my head. There was no use guessing with him. I knew better than anyone that Elodin was cracked as the potter's cobbles.
"Long ago," Elodin said conversationally, not taking his eyes from the courtyard below, "when folk spoke differently, this used to be called the Quoyen Hale. Later, they called it the Questioning Hall, and students made a game of writing questions on slips of paper and letting them blow about. Rumor had it, you could divine your answer by which way the paper left the square."
He pointed to the roads that left gaps between the gray buildings.
"Yes, no, maybe, elsewhere, soon."
He shrugged.
"It was all a mistake, though. Bad translation. They thought Quoyen was an early root of Quetenten, question, but it isn't. Quoyen means wind. This is rightly named the House of the Wind."
I waited a moment to see if he intended to say any more. When nothing was forthcoming, I got slowly to my feet.
"That's interesting, Master."
I hesitated, not sure how serious he had been before.
"But I should be going."
Elodin nodded absently and gave a wave that was half farewell, half dismissal. His eyes never left the courtyard below, following the ever-changing wind. Back in my room at Anchor's, I sat on my bed for a long minute in the dark, trying to decide what to do. My thoughts were muddy. I was weary, wounded, and still a little drunk. The adrenaline that had kept me going earlier was slowly turning sour, and my side burned and stung. I took a deep breath and tried to focus my thoughts. I'd been moving on instinct so far, but now I needed to think things through carefully. Could I go to the Masters for help? For a moment, hope rose in my chest, then fell. No. I had no proof that Ambrose was responsible. What's more, if I told them the whole story, I would have to admit that I used sympathy to blind and burn my attackers. Self-defense or no, what I'd done was unquestionably malfeasance. Students had been expelled for less than that just to preserve the university's reputation. No. I couldn't risk being expelled over this. And if I went to the Medica, there would be too many questions. And word of my injury would get around if I went in to get stitched. That meant Ambrose would know how close he had come to succeeding. It would be better to give the impression that I had walked away unscathed. I had no idea how long Ambrose's hired killers had been following me. One of them had said, "We already lost him twice." That means they could know I had a room here at Anchor's. I might not be safe here. I locked the window and drew the curtain before turning on my hand lamp. The light revealed the forgotten piece of paper that had been wedged into my window. I unfolded it and read, "Quoth, getting up here is every bit as much fun as you made it look. However, springing your window took some time. Finding you not at home, I hope you do not mind me borrowing paper and ink enough to leave this note. As you are not playing downstairs or peacefully abed, a cynical person might wonder what you are doing at this late hour, and if you are up to no good. Alas, I shall have to walk back home tonight without the comfort of your escort or the pleasure of your company. I missed you this felling past at the Aeolian, but though denied your company, I had the good fortune to meet someone quite interesting. He is a quite singular fellow, and I am eager to tell you what little I can of him, when next we meet. I currently have rooms at the Swan and Swale. Swale? In Imre. Please call on me before the 23rd of this month, and we will have our lunch, belated. After that, I will be about on my business. Your friend and apprentice housebreaker, Denna. Postscript. Please rest assured that I did not notice the disgraceful condition of your bed linens, and did not judge your character thereby." Today was the 28th. The letter didn't have a date, but it had probably been there for at least a span and a half.
She must have left it only a few days after the fire in the fishery. I briefly tried to decide how I felt about it. Flattered that she had tried to find me, furious that the note had gone unfound until now, as to the matter of the fellow that she had met. It was far too much for me to deal with at the moment, weary, wounded, and still somewhat the worse for drink. Instead, I quickly cleaned the shallow cut as best I could using my wash basin. I would have put some stitches in it myself, but I couldn't get a good angle. It started bleeding again, and I cut off the cleaner pieces of my ruined shirt to fashion a makeshift bandage. Blood. The men who tried to kill me still had the dowsing compass, and I'd undoubtedly left some of my blood on his knife. Blood would be vastly more effective in a dowsing compass than a simple hair. That meant that even if they didn't already know where I lived, they might be able to find me despite the precautions I'd taken. I moved around my room quickly, stuffing everything of value into my travel sack, as I didn't know when it would be safe to return. Under a stack of papers, I found a small folding knife I'd forgotten about after I'd won it off Sim playing corners. It would be worth next to nothing in a fight, but that was better than nothing at all. Then I grabbed my loot and cloak and snuck downstairs into the kitchen, where I was lucky enough to find an empty Valaisian wine pot with a wide mouth. It was a minor piece of luck, but I was glad for whatever I could get at this point. I headed east and crossed the river, but didn't go all the way into Imre proper. Instead, I headed south a bit to where a few docks, a seedy inn, and a handful of houses perched on the bank of the wide Omethi River. It was a small port that serviced Imre, too small to have a name of its own. I stuffed my bloody shirt into the wine pot and made it watertight with a piece of sympathy wax. Then I dropped it in the Omethi River and watched it bob slowly downstream. If they were dowsing for my blood, it would seem like I was heading south, running. Hopefully, they'd follow it.